Chapter 16. Surviving Messina. Gideon's Omen. Nothing lasts forever. Harlan gave me a great bear hug, and Kara timidly kissed my cheek on tiptoe. I gazed at them both, hardly believing it. "You have a habit of coming back from the dead," I said to Harlan. "I'm just glad it's real this time." He frowned. "What do you mean?" "I'll explain later. I refuse to explain anything more until you tell me how this is possible."
"Why don't we go inside?" Ravenna suggested.
He led us back up the path through the punz trees and across glades where the light was stained gold by the fleshy orange leaves that formed the canopy. Brilliantly feathered lizards flitted from branch to branch, and diaphanous insects the size of a man's open palm fluttered like seed cases in the humid breeze. Ravenna's force chair hissed over the ground a few centimetres in the air, surrounded and suspended by a spherical field generated by the slowly revolving and tilting anti-gravity hoop that encircled it. Beyond the wooded slope, the ground was flooded. A vast lake of yellow liquid stretched out under the jungle canopy that sprouted up from the water in lurid clumps. Fronds, rushes, and fibrously rooted trees formed hammock islets in the lake, along with batteries of puffy mauve or orange zutes, with giant leaves and tangles of saprophytic vines. Antigrav walkboards bridged out across the resinous water, linking the dry land to Ravenna's camp by way of several of the hammocks. The camp had been raised on a dual-alloy raft, 20 meters square, held above the water by locked, cycling repulsor lift pods. Angular, geometric, the structure the raft supported looked like a giant tent, but I realized from its gentle shimmer that it was formed from intersecting fields of opaque force energy. We went in through the one-way field membrane that formed the door and entered a cool, climate-controlled chamber lit by glow globes. Equipment was stacked up in metal containers, and there were several items of collapsible furniture. Further screens denoted adjoining rooms, veiled off. A grey-haired man in a linen robe was working at a small camp table, reviewing data on a portable codifier. Kara unfolded three more of the stacked camp chairs, while Harlan fetched bottles of chilled fruit water and some shrink-wrapped ration packs. A young woman came in from one of the other rooms and conferred quietly with the man at the codifier. "You're busy here, I see," I said.
"Yes," said Ravenna. "The view should be good."
I didn't quite understand what he meant, but I let it pass. There were other things on my mind. Harlan thumb-popped the cap of a bottle and passed it to me before taking his seat.
"Here's to us all, still alive despite the odds."
He clinked his bottle against mine, and Kara toasted with hers. "Well," I said.
"A bunch of hard-ass merc bastards smoked the distaff. Took the whole spire out. Killed the lot of them,"
Harlan said, matter-of-factly, but there was still an edge of rage in his voice. "And you?"
"Madame Beckwin saved us," said Kara.
"What?"
"We got her back to Messina, okay? Stable," said Kara. "The Medicaid facility at the Distaff Hall made her comfortable. They got me back on my feet in about a week. Then Madame Beckwin suddenly took a turn for the worse."
"She stroked out,"
growled Harlan.
"A really bad wuss is called. Cerebrovascular ischemia,"
Ravenna said quietly.
"It was beyond the abilities or resources of the Hall's Medicaid, so we rushed her to Sanders Cedar Municipal General for surgery," said Kara. "We knew you wouldn't want us to leave her there alone, so we stayed with her in shifts. I took one watch and alternated with Nail. On the night the Hall was raided, I had just started my shift."
"And I was on my way back to Spire 11 in an air cab,"
finished Harlan. "So neither of you were there?"
"No."
"You two and Elizabeth all survived?"
"Lucky us, eh?"
said Harlan. "Where is she?" I asked. "And how is she?"
"Never regained consciousness. She's on vital support in my ship's infirmary," Ravenna replied. "My personal physician is tending her."
I knew Dr. Antrobus, Gideon's Medicaid. Beckwin couldn't be in more experienced hands. I looked back at Harlan and Kara. I could tell the Loki-born ex-bounty hunter was enjoying stringing this tale out. He'd probably been rehearsing it for weeks. "So, go on."
"We went to ground, me and Kara. We couldn't move Madame B, so we signed her in under a fake identity so she couldn't be linked to your operation. Then me and Kara went hunting. We caught up with the hit squad at a shantytown liftport down in the suburbs. 30 of them. Bessarine Janissaries, no less. Never tangled with those brothers before, though I'd heard of them, of course. Now could they fight like bastards?
I've seen them up close.
Then you'll appreciate that 2 against 30, even with the drop to us, was hardball. I smoked 3 of them.
2, corrected Kara. It was 2.
Okay, 2 definites and a probable. Kara, may the Emperor bless her, took out 6 of the pigs. Blam, blam, blam.
We can split a bottle of Amasek while you give me a play-by-play later, Nail. Stick to the meat.
My family motto, Chief.
Harlan grinned.
Well, as it turned out, me and Kara had probably bitten off a sight more than we could chew, and we ended up cornered in a freight yard next to the lift port. Backs to the wall time. Last stand. A change of underwear moment. And then, just like that,
he clicked his fingers.
Salvation arrived.
He looked over at Inquisitor Ravenna.
Just glad I was able to help,
Ravenna demurred.
Help? Him and his kill team kicked ass. Far as I could tell, only 8 of the mercs got out alive, jumped their ship, and ran off-world.
I set my empty bottle down on the duralloy floor and sat forward with my elbows on my knees. So, Gideon, I said, how in the name of terror did you come to be there on Messina at the right time?
I wasn't, he said. I was there at the wrong time. If I'd reached Messina a day earlier, I'd have been there at the right time. But my ship was delayed by a warp storm that also shut down my communications.
That's the second time since I arrived you've been enigmatic, I said. Is that any way to treat your old master? Gideon Ravenna had been my interrogator and pupil back in the late 330s, the most promising inquisitorial candidate I had ever met. A level Delta latent psyker with a PQ of 171, he had also possessed a genius intellect rounded out with a fine education and an athlete's physique. During the Holy Novena on Thracian Primaris, he had been caught up in the infamous atrocity, and his body had been woefully crippled. Since that time, he had lived within the cocoon of his force chair, a brilliant mind sustained within a paralyzed, useless frame. But that had not stopped him from becoming one of the Inquisition's finest agents. I myself had sponsored his promotion to full Inquisitor status in 346. Since then, he had successfully prosecuted hundreds of cases, the most notable being the Gomek violation, and, of course, the Servan-Holman affair on Sarum. He had also penned several works of considerable insight. The celebrated essays Towards an Imperial Utopia, Reflections on the Hive State, and Terra Redux, a history of the early Inquisition, a study of warpcraft that was fast becoming a standard primer, and a work called The Mirror of Smoke that dealt with man's interaction with the warp state with such conspicuous perception and poetry that I believed it would survive as much as art as it was instruction. Ravenna was all but invisible within the dim globe of his chair's field, just a shapeless shadow suspended in the fizzling gloom. His body was utterly redundant, and everything he did was performed by Psyforce alone. His mind had grown stronger in his infirmity, compensating for the things denied him. I was sure he was now much more than a level Delta psionic.
My work in the last few years has required me to develop an understanding of divination and prophecy, Gideon said slowly. Things have been revealed to me. Things of great significance.
I could tell he was being very careful about what he said. It was as if he wished to tell me more, but didn't dare. I decided I should respect his caution and allow him to tell me only what he felt he could.
One of those revelations, a vision, if you like, forecast that a violent fate would befall the distaff on Messina. The event was predicted to the precise hour, but I couldn't get there in time to prevent it.
The destruction of the distaff was predicted, I said.
With distressing accuracy, he replied.
I suddenly realized I was hearing his voice, by which I mean the voice Ravenna had used before his terrible injuries, a voice produced by a man whose mouth and larynx had not been melted by burning promethium. I had become so used to the monotonous synthetic speech of his chair's psi-activated voxponder.
My work has also allowed me to perfect stronger psionic abilities, he said,
and one of them was clearly reading my surface thoughts.
I ditched the voxponder about a year ago. I have developed enough psionic control to broadcast my speech naturally.
I'm hearing you in my head.
Yes, Gregor. Hearing the voice you're used to. It doesn't work with untouchables or psychically shielded individuals, of course.
That's why I keep the old voxbinder on standby.
He uttered the last part of his sentence mechanically via the toneless voice box built into his chair, and the grating, emotion-free electronic words made us all laugh with surprise.
Though I was too late to save the distaff, I got Kara, Harlan, and Elizabeth to safety off-world.
For that you have my gratitude. But why summon me so far off the beaten track to meet with you?
Promedy has secrets that we need, he said.
What manner of secrets?
I have been allowed to see the future, Gregor, Ravenna said. And it isn't pretty. Imperial culture has never set much store by divination, Gideon told me. I have come to suspect this is a great weakness.
It was much later. Night had fallen over the swampy bayou, and the air was dancing with bioluminescent flies. Ravenna and I had taken a stroll along the grav walks behind his camp.
A weakness? Surely it is a greater weakness to take it seriously. If we believe the rantings of every dribbling marketplace seer, of every demented ecclesiarchy prophet who claimed to have been granted divine revelations,
we would be mad, true. Most of it is rubbish, lies, mischief, the delusions of broken minds. Sometimes prophetic insights are genuine, but they are usually made by psychers who have either done it by accident or who are insane. In either case, the visions are untrustworthy or too confused to be interpreted in any practical, useful way. But just because mankind isn't very good at it doesn't mean it can't be done.
It is my understanding that other races are reputed to excel at it, I said.
That has certainly been my experience, he replied. Serving the Ordo Xenos has been enlightening. The more I have studied alien races in order to discern their weaknesses, the more I have learned their strengths.
We are talking about the Eldar, aren't we? I risked the question. He didn't reply immediately. His last words had been close to heresy. The force sphere around him flickered slightly with anxiety.
They are a strange breed. They are able to read the invisible geography of space-time and unravel probability with great precision. But they are mercurial. Sometimes they use their insight as a lever to change the outcome of events. Sometimes they stand idle and watch as prophecies play out. I believe there is no human alive who can explain why they make the choices they do. We just don't see things the way they do.
Their greater lifespan gives them greater perspective.
It's partly that. Although orthodox thinking would say that greater perspective is their curse. The Ministorum believes the Eldar are too resigned to destiny, that they are indolent and almost cruel, or else brutally manipulative.
You don't think so?
I'll admit only a selfish fascination, Gregor. They interact with the fundamental structure of the universe, as you might well appreciate. Any talent for living or perceiving beyond one's physical body is attractive to me. My work has...
He broke off. Gideon?
I wanted to learn something of the way their minds witness reality independent of their bodies. Their farseers, for example, have a kinesthetic sensibility that operates regardless of the restraints of time and space.
We paused at the edge of a walkway and looked out across the misty nocturnal swamp. Glowing insects and airborne spores drifted in the air, their paths occasionally punctuated by the sudden swoops of aerial night hunters. Sinuous things moved through the glistening water below the floating walkways, barely disturbing the oily surface.
I've said too much, he murmured.
You do not need to be guarded with me, Gideon. I will not judge you for seeking knowledge. I'm not the Puritan you once knew.
I know. I would tell you if I could. But in order to learn certain things, I have been forced to make promises.
To the Eldar?
I cannot even confirm that. I am not proud of the promises, but I will honor them.
Then what can you tell me? You said that things had been revealed to you.
One of their kind has foreseen a great darkness ahead of us all. It is so abrupt and acute that it has twisted and altered the skeins of probability that the Eldar read. It was revealed to him in a sequence of connected visions. One of those was the destruction of the distaff. When that came true, I was shaken. It proved the visions were not fanciful.
What else has he seen? I asked.
A living blade, a man-machine, bestriding a long-dead world and preparing to strike a blow that will spill human and Eldar blood alike, he said. After that, nothing.
I looked down at him.
Nothing.
Nothing. That vision is the most distant thing he is now able to see. It's no more than 6 months from now. Beyond that, he has been unable to glimpse anything at all.
Why?
Because there is no future left to see.